and you're listening to The Third Degree, QSER's Environmental and Social Justice Half Hour. My name is James Hitchcock. On today's show, we're looking at fly-in, fly-out workers and the emotional and other impacts of this phenomena. The most recent Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change report. But first, an update on the clashes at the James Price Point gas project site in Western Australia. Now, this is a story that we've talked about a number of times on the show, and I'm sure that you've heard it in the media. Over in Western Australia, the Brim community is continuing to fight to prevent Woodside Petroleum and its partners constructing a massive liquefied natural gas processing plant. Now, the site for the plant over at James Price Point takes in a number of sacred sites of traditional owners. An environmentalist say it will have a devastating impact on the local wildlife, environmental heritage, and also on climate change. Now, if you've been in Broome or Northern Australia, you know that the wet season is a time when little major construction work can happen, and so things have been rather quiet there. But coming into the dry season now, the standoff between Woodside and protesters and the police has been heating up again. And last week saw what looks to be the start of a long dry season of conflict. The Third Degree's Simon Ammon spoke with Glenn Glistoskafy, National Kimberley Campaigner for the Wilderness Society.
Last year, what we saw was the local community strongly opposed the gas hub proposed for James Price Point near Broome. This year, we saw a very slow start to the work schedule from Woodside, the main company involved. But about 2 weeks ago, we started hearing rumours about a major police deployment from the state government to try and allow the Woodside equipment to come into the site again, because they've had great difficulties getting past the local community, who often would stand in front of the convoys of machinery, even getting into arrestable situations. So the Premier deployed up to 250 police, and they started arriving in Broome about a week and a half ago. And since then, essentially, there's been two local grandmothers, no other arrests, and the Woodside equipment has gone through to the site. That hasn't changed the fact that the Broome community still strongly opposes the project.
Why do you think that the government in Western Australia has decided that much police protection is necessary?
It's a very good question. The Premier has obfuscated around that. He claimed that professional protesters were driving the community reaction against Woodside's development. The reality is that virtually everybody who's been arrested and virtually everybody who's been blockading the Woodside operations has been a local community member. And the two grandmothers who were arrested last week have both been in the Broome community for well over a decade and beyond that. So we think that the justification is actually the Premier saying to the companies who now don't really want to go to James Price Point, he's saying to them, we will back you with whatever you need. If you need a taxpayer-funded security force to build your project, we will pay for that. And that was the message, I think, to the companies last week. It came straight after some new investors into the project said that they don't want to go to James Price Point.
So why is that? Why is there this uncertainty now amongst these investors in actually investing into this particular project? And what are the alternatives that they're considering?
Well, there's uncertainty for a couple of big reasons. Number one is commercially it's probably not the cheapest option. There's existing facilities about 500 kilometres down the road in the Pilbara. Most of the companies involved own those existing facilities. They would much prefer to use the existing gas factory rather than build a new one. But more than that, in the last 12 months, we have seen one of the most monumental community reactions against a project in Australian history. It's an incredibly complex project. It's very hard for people on the East Coast to understand the scale of this project. It requires a 5 kilometre by 5 kilometre concrete slab. It'll require 3,000 or 4,000 construction workers, 6 years to build the facility. Now, that's under ideal circumstances. If the local community oppose it, if the local community is willing to put their bodies in front of bulldozers to get arrested, to go to jail, then the chances of them being able to build this project in an economic way are very much diminished. So the companies are now looking at their reputations, their public image, and they're thinking, this is a very bad project for us.
You mentioned just now how many jobs this might bring to the Broome community. I mean, is there a sort of a sense of division amongst the community in Broome between those who are looking forward to this kind of massive investment in the area and those who are opposed to the project?
Look, to understand the opposition in the local community, the reality is that this sort of project is huge. It's massive. It'll virtually be all fly-in, fly-out workers. There'll be very few locals employed. There'll be very few local Indigenous people employed. And when the gas factory is operational, there'll be 450 jobs.
What's the current mood at the camp at James Price Point and around town?
Yeah.
Given that there's been this massive police sort of force posted to the area?
Look, I think the police force deployment was a massive mistake. It has reinforced the local community's objections to the project. They have become even more steely in their resolve against the project. They know that this fight could go on for many years. They are hoping, as long as we are, that the companies will make the statement that the project's not viable at James Price Point. The earlier they make that statement, the better for everybody. So there's a little bit of a stalemate, but one thing is for sure, the people of Broome are not going to back down. They've seen the future of mining. It's down the road at the Pilbara. It hasn't helped the people of the Pilbara. It's not going to help the people of Broome. They've seen the manifestation of it for 30 years, and they don't want it. And the Premier at the moment seems to have no friends in his determination to try and make this project happen.
And that's Glenn Glostoskopy of the Wilderness Society speaking with the Third Degree's Simon Unwin about the James Price Point gas project. Now, for many people, the mining industry is offered the opportunity for job security and wealth, but it also means a large amounts of time away from family and friends in far-off places. The practice of having a fly-in, fly-out workforce, or FIFO, as you will hear it referred to in this report, is favoured by companies as preferential to the costs of setting up services that would attract families and workers, that would be needed to attract families and workers to live nearby. This means large mining companies don't need to commit to a particular location and can move on to a new site with greater ease. But what are the impacts of rosters that see 2 weeks on, 1 week off, on workers and their families? Now, fly-in, fly-out workers, or FIFO, or also drive-in, drive-out for those who prefer to drive rather than fly, or DIDO, as you will hear it referred to in this report, are currently the focus of a federal government inquiry with the findings to be released later this year. 2SER's Courtney Payne spoke with Nicole Ashby, the founder of Fly In, Fly Out Families.
I guess it's initially a big adjustment. So it can be quite a big transition, especially if you've got children, to being a double parent family to a solo parent, and then having to do that solo parenting 24/7 for however long that FIFO partner is away, which is obviously heightened, or there's more pressure the longer that you're away. I think that most popular roster in WA is 2 weeks on, 1 week off. So it largely comes down to the roster.
And do you think that, I guess for the families, when they think about these jobs, like these effects and these outcomes are kind of a bit of a surprise, or it's kind of rushed into it because it's, you know, it's so much money and that's going to benefit the family, that these sort of things don't get discussed and it's sort of all happening?
Yeah, and I remember when my husband started doing FIFO, and we did it for financial reasons, and I said to one of my girlfriends who was doing the same, her husband was doing the same roster, how do you cope? Because I was quite concerned, and she said, well, you just do it, you just get through it. And that's largely been the attitude, is that, well, you just do it and you basically deal with issues as they arise, which may not be the most effective way to do it, especially if you've got a family crisis or you're feeling really isolated. That can be quite a dangerous situation to be in.
So you have started an organisation which is FIFO Families. Mm-hmm. Was this based on this experience that you were sort of thinking, you know, this isn't really working for me, there must be other people, like you said, talking to your girlfriend, how it kind of came about, or was it a conscious decision, or you just started building this network of people that you didn't actually know before?
It was a very conscious decision, and it came through doing a course that I was doing, and I was actually trying to think of how I could set up a business. And I kept getting stuck, though, with my children who were all at that stage four and under, so between 6 months old and four, we've got three kids, and trying to figure out how I could set up a business. But I kept getting stuck because I had three kids at home, all you know, under school age, for 28 days on my own. And I said to my mentor, how can I do anything when I've got three kids under four at home with me for 28 days, 24/7? And he said, well, if it's a problem for you, it's a problem for other people. And that was the biggest aha moment in my life. And straight from that moment, I thought, oh, my God, that's it. That's what it is. There's no, you know, I have limited support around me. So if I've got limited support, others are going to have limited support. And I knew from that moment that I had to be able to set up very much localized community groups where fly-in, fly-out and drive-in, drive-out families could meet. And it had to be across Australia from the word go.
And so how many groups do you have across Australia at the moment? Obviously not everywhere has mining.
Yeah, but you can fly in, fly out from anywhere.
Yeah, of course, yes.
So we've got 14 in WA, we've got 5 in Queensland, 1 in Darwin, 1 in Adelaide. We've got 2 getting off the ground in Tasmania and 1 in central Victoria, or regional Victoria.
And for the people who have experienced being a part of the FIFO family so far, what have they said the experience has been like, or the effects of finally connecting with these other people?
Absolutely nothing but positive comments. And just really quite often what you get in these comments is a sense of relief that I'm not alone. You know, 'cause some of these families could be the only family they know wherever they're living. You know, say if it's in Bendigo in Victoria, that could be the only family that they know that's doing fly in, fly out. So just connecting with others on a virtual level online just gives them such a sense of relief, and they know that they've got people that they can now communicate with and run any issues, you know, by. So if they're having, I guess, any challenging times, they've got a whole community who they can bounce back on and ask for advice and guidance.
At the moment, obviously, the government's kind of caught on to the multiple effects of fly-in, fly-out jobs and are doing a national inquiry mm-hmm. into the experience for workers and, I guess, family members and people who are impacted on through this type of work. What would you like to see happen based on the outcome of this, or what areas are you really concerned about that need to be addressed in terms of this type of work? Lifestyle?
Yeah, so there was a few things that I recommended to the Federal FIFO Inquiry, and that was that we need some national guidelines or benchmarks that are introduced into the industry, particularly around the rostering. So having either flexibility in a roster, so Rio Tinto quite often will offer a 2-in-1 or an 8 days on, 6 days off roster. 2-in-1, you get paid more money, but you're away for 2/3 of the year. 8 and 6 is almost, you know, equal time on to off, but you get paid a bit less, but it's much more family friendly. So having things like that in place so families can make the best choice for them and workers can make a decision based around their, you know, work-life balance, because that's something that doesn't really exist in some of the different rosters across the country. So that was largely, that was the first part. And the second part was offering something, again, that's quite formalised and that all FIFO workers can access, and it may be introduced at induction or just across the sector. But using FIFO families and modelling FIFO families on what some sectors of the defence use, and would pull bits of the model that work so that the defence families use. So, for example, they offer inductions, or they'll have pre-deployment sessions where they bring the families in. And this only relates to some sectors of the defence, and it's not I've been getting information from families. It's not across the board. But really what I'm saying there is we just need to educate the workers and the families on the impacts and prepare families for what they will encounter, you know, doing that, having that FIFO lifestyle, and then having access to those localised community support groups across the country.
And that was a Panacea's Courtney Payne speaking with Nicole Ashby, the founder of Fly In, Fly Out Families. And you're listening to the Third Degree Environmental and Social Justice Half Hour here on 2SER 107.3. Now, talking about some of the personal and family-orientated impacts of fossil fuel expansion and mining projects, to talking about some of the global climate change. One of the most recent reports released by the UN's Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change warns that the risk of extreme weather events around the world is increasing at a rapid pace. Now, this is particularly of concern for nations in the global south, who in many cases lack the resources to respond to such emergencies and are often likely to be the first and hardest hit. 2SER's Albion Harrison-Nash discussed the report with Phil Ireland from Oxfam Australia.
The latest IPCC report essentially confirms a lot of what we already know about what's happening to the climate, but it also provides an extra layer of detail around extreme events and disasters and the kind of things we're likely to see in the coming years.
Was there anything surprising that came out of the report at all, or was it really just some confirmation of what we already sort of, or many people assume to be the case?
There was extra detail added. So we know now that there are definitely raised temperatures at a global scale, in particular around maximum daily temperatures and maximum minimums. The number of warm days has increased and the number of cold days has decreased. We've seen that the number of heavy rain events has increased in many regions around the world. And we've also seen, obviously, a rise in sea level of around 20 centimetres over the last 200 years.
And how significant are the findings of this report for the developing world, particularly in regards to planning for mitigation?
Yeah, the report, once again, it affirms what we already know, that the time to act has passed. I mean, we need to urgently reduce our emissions to reduce the long-term impacts of climate change. This just highlights the urgency for that action. If we don't turn emissions around radically, and I mean peaking global emissions within the next few years, the kind of impacts we're going to see that are going to be very difficult to adapt to at all in both developed countries like Australia and developing countries. So this really highlights the urgency and the need of mitigating our emissions.
And surely, hopefully as a result of this report, there will need to be a renewed focus on climate change adaption within aid programs and development assistance. How do you see this perhaps playing out?
Yeah, so climate change adaptation should be a focus of a whole range of development programs. And at the Durban Climate Conference last year, they established the board of what's called the Green Climate Fund, which is the new fund that's been set up, kind of like the Global Fund for AIDS and HIV that we've already seen. The Green Climate Fund will provide support to nations to adapt to climate change. So that's there, but the problem is that it's essentially an empty shell, and there have been very few commitments forthcoming. So the real gap in all this is that we know what needs to be done in many places, and we know how to support local communities who are vulnerable to extreme weather events, but there isn't the structures and the funding that's required. And there are so many opportunities to raise funding that the international community has just been a bit slow to respond to.
Speaking of that, the climate fund you were just mentioning before, I take it that since Durban there haven't been any commitments of funds for it?
Off the top of my head, I couldn't give you exact figures, but I understand the total amount currently pledged is less than $100 million. And essentially what's been pledged is around getting the administration of the fund up and running. No one's really committed yet to providing money that will go towards adaptation until those structures are set up. And of course, the Green Climate Fund is a part of the $100 billion per year commitment that developed countries made in Copenhagen, and they reaffirmed in Cancun and Durban, and that's $100 billion per year by 2020 to go towards things like helping developing countries mitigate mitigate their greenhouse gas emissions, but also to help them adapt to the impacts of climate change. But that money has not been forthcoming, and countries haven't taken up opportunities, including Australia, to actually generate the kinds of finance that we suspect will be required.
And does having a green climate fund, particularly one without the funding actually going to it, have a danger of taking attention away within the rest of planning in aid and development from climate change concerns within other sort of, you know, planning for other events and other types of aid where that might need to be a concern? Would we see that perhaps it's not thought about so much or planned for so much because that fund is theoretically the place to be doing that?
It's an interesting question. Up until now, we've had the problem that there are so many different funds. There are over 14 dedicated climate funds. At Oxfam, we describe it as like a spaghetti bowl of funds with so many different channels, but all don't have enough money in them. So it's actually been quite a disparate system up until now. And the point about the Green Climate Fund is that we kind of consolidate that as a one-stop shop for climate change adaptation and mitigation support. Now, of course, no development agency, and particularly Oxfam, doesn't want to see efforts towards climate change adaptation and mitigation take away from the good work that's being done by development organisations around the world. So it'd be a terrible situation where support for vaccinations or education was then redirected into climate change adaptation. And that's why most development agencies say that support for this kind of thing has to be new and additional to existing aid commitments.
And if the outcomes presented in this report are not prevented and we do see something in the order of what is predicted, do you think that the wealthy nations around the world will bear some of the responsibility towards repairing the damage done to poorer nations by these disasters?
That's a tricky question. There's no doubt that developed countries have a responsibility to reduce their emissions and reduce them as fast as possible so that we don't see those kind of impacts. And developed countries also have a responsibility to support developing countries cope with the impacts that are unavoidable. Because as this report's shown, there are some changes we're already seeing and will see, no matter how much we can reduce our emissions, simply because the carbon dioxide's already locked into the system. So developing countries have a responsibility to reduce their emissions and support developing countries adapt to the impacts of climate change.
And I know, again, it's a slightly broad question and there's going to be a variety of answers, but just generally and briefly, how are developing nations generally placed in terms of being able to reduce the impact of extreme weather events if they do increase? Is it really going to be starting from scratch in trying to build the ability to cope with these things, or is there already, I suppose, a reasonable amount of work being done?
I think it's mixed across the board, but it's actually fairly patchy, and there are a lot of really vulnerable countries and vulnerable people who don't have the systems in place to deal with the impacts of climate change. Something that came out of this report, it said that islands in the Pacific are particularly vulnerable because we're going to be seeing rising sea levels coupled with more intense cyclones. And those two things together lead to really intense storm surges, which basically can cover Pacific islands in salty water. That poisons the crops that people need for their food. It poisons the fresh water holes where they can collect water. There's a whole range of really quite scary vulnerabilities. I mean, in Bangladesh, you've got a whole range of people living in the coastal delta, which will also see more intense coastal cyclones and rising sea levels. And the saltwater intrusion will challenge people's ability to grow crops. Having said that, there are a range of measures that developing countries and NGOs in the development sector can be doing right now to support these countries. In the Pacific, we can be building and supporting the construction of rainwater, better rainwater gathering and storage to kind of deal with those droughts and extremes.
You were just touching on there on some of the more obvious and immediate ways in which we could start to help developing nations, but in this example, the Pacific ones, in preparing for these changes. Are there any other more sort of widespread quite obvious and straightforward examples of things that the international community could start doing quite rapidly?
Yeah, I mean, that's a great question, and the answer is yes. An example is Oxfam currently has a project in Sri Lanka, I think, where it's providing training programs to women and men around good gardening techniques. And these include using less water and increasing soil fertility so that agricultural production is more efficient. It's about creating better garden designs for small spaces. It's about recycling garden materials so everything's used more sustainably. And also saving traditional seed varieties so you're not having to go out and buy seeds every new season. These are the kind of things that help people deal with both vulnerability in the present and also future projections of climate change. And there are good programs happening all around the world, and a lot of this knowledge and a lot of these approaches already exist in developing countries. They need to be supported by the right approaches, but also financing that isn't adequately provided as yet.
And just finally, do you think it's likely that this report will have a strong influence on policymakers and their approach to aid and development programs?
It's hard to say, but I certainly think this report will be taken into account. I know AusAid has certainly looked at this report quite closely, and the kind of models and predictions that this provides are very helpful to aid programs and the kind of efforts moving forward. I mean, what I think we actually need to see in Australia, though, is politicians taking reports like this a little more seriously. Australia's current mitigation ambition of a 5% reduction in greenhouse gas emissions on 2000 levels by 2020 is woefully inadequate when you look at global emissions. We need to increase that target in line with what the science says we need to do to reduce emissions. Just next week, Australia is going to the international climate negotiations in Bonn to continue to talk about and move forward on how we can build international solutions to climate change. Australia needs to go to that meeting prepared to increase the ambition of its greenhouse gas reduction targets and also prepared to sign up to the Kyoto Protocol, which is the bedrock of the international climate regime and an essential stepping stone towards a comprehensive global deal that will see the kind of emission reductions that the world needs.
And that was 2SER's Albion Harrison-Nash discussing the latest UN climate change report with Phil Island from Oxfam Australia. Well, and we have come to the end of another show here this week. Stay tuned next week, where we'll be looking at the cutting of incentives for green buildings in this year's federal budget, and we'll continue our special series on e-waste. Until then, the show has been The Third Degree on 2SER 107.3, and my name is James Hitchcock. Stay tuned for The Daily, coming up next. Thank you.